Welcome to the Boom Clap Podcast. Today you have Rita here flying solo. Most of you who are regular listeners probably already know this, that I was put on indefinite unpaid leave from my job at the hospital where I was a CVICU nurse for the last over 15 years. Since February 6, 2006, I was employed with the same hospital, but I was put on indefinite unpaid leave on August 11th of this year, 2021. If you're not a regular listener, that might be news to you. We are going to get into that whole situation. I haven't really covered publicly exactly what happened on any platform yet because it was all still very up in the air, and I just felt it best not to cover every single detail until things were finalized. And I wouldn't even say things are finalized now, but I think I'm at a point where they've made their peace and I can start talking much more publicly about what has happened. So we're going to get into that later on in the podcast, exactly the events that took place. It all changed yesterday a little bit. I am released from my job. They are saying I resigned, which is not true. I'm saying I was fired because I specifically told them I didn't resign, and we will talk more about that. But first, I just want to run through some numbers, because a couple days ago, I just started asking the question, which I've been asking this for a while, but just out loud, like, I just want to yell, what are we doing? What are we doing? I typed it in all caps to Cecily multiple times. She typed it back to me multiple times in all caps, because it just doesn't make sense. When you step back, look at the numbers, look at things happening around you, stop listening to all these talking points and talking heads on TV and talking heads at the hospital and hospital administrators and all these just words, breakthrough cases, hospitalizations, cases, all of this. Like, just stop and look at the hard facts. And what are we doing? Why are we making every waking decision surrounding this? We'll get into why I think that is at the end. Okay, so let's run through some numbers to start. Now, the hospital I work in is located in Champaign County, Illinois. So this is where I'm going to base these first numbers off of. This is not our entire care area by any means. So hospital numbers are a little bit different than these numbers I will give you here, but this is because this is a good way to get solid numbers to link to so you can see, okay? So to start, we're going to talk about Champaign County, Illinois. So census on July 1st, 2019, that was the latest census I could grab, was 209,689 people. So Champaign County, Illinois, that is the number of people living within the county. As of 10:05 this morning, Saturday morning, the 30th of October, there were 334 positive cases in Champaign County. That is 0.16% of the population. So just over a tenth of a percent of the population is sick, not sick, I'm not sure, but that was positive cases. So 334 positive cases. They didn't indicate sick, not sick. There are hospitalizations listed. I think the number was 8 of that number, 334. 8 or 9. I think it was 8 yesterday and 9 today, actually. So we have 0.16% of the population in the county is a case right now. Okay, so let's move on to the hospital I worked at. Let's move on to those emails. I've been tracking the last 4 weeks cases that they've put out within the hospital, people who are positive cases, and vaccinated versus unvaccinated staff members. Okay, they put out these hikes emails weekly. At the beginning of the email, I do want to note there is a ad-looking picture that will have a picture of somebody's arm getting a shot. It's different every week. And it says, do it for me. Don't wait to vaccinate. Marketing campaign every week at the beginning of these emails. It goes through all the numbers in the hospital, numbers of staff, all of that. So I'm going to run through the weekly numbers here for the last 4 weeks. Okay. And this is staff members. So staff team members that are out, counted as a positive case, and then the number vaccinated of those positive cases, okay? That's what I'm running through. Okay, October 1st through 7th, there were 22 new team members out positive for COVID. Of those 22, 8 were fully vaccinated. That is 36% out were fully vaccinated. October 8th through 14th, 23 new team members were out with COVID, or I shouldn't say with COVID, were positive for COVID. So this doesn't delineate whether they were sick, asymptomatic, etc. It just says positive for COVID. Of that 23, 16 were fully vaccinated. That is 70% of the positive cases that week. 70% of the staff members who were positive for COVID that week were fully vaccinated. October 15th through 21st, 29 new positive team members. Of the 29 positive, 15 were fully vaccinated. 52%. 52% out were fully vaccinated. October 22nd through 28th, 18 new positive team members out. 12 of the 18 were fully vaccinated, 67%. Now, it's important to note when you go through those numbers, every single unvaccinated team member had to be tested. So you're picking up every single person who is symptomatic, every single person who's unsymptomatic, asymptomatic. The vaccinated team members are only being tested if they request a test. If they call the COVID hotline, say I have symptoms, and get tested. They are not tested for exposures or anything else. Only if they have symptoms and they call the hotline and request a test. So last week, based on those numbers of 18 positive members, team members out with COVID, that's 0.16%, 0.16% of staff across all hospital campuses, all staff, 18 out of 11,000 employees were positive, 0.16%. What are we doing? I mean, it's just interesting to me also. I want to know, I've gotten messages from other nurses and techs and other staff members at the hospital who have been sick also. They've had sinus infections, other illnesses, and they're, you know, as long as they're negative for COVID, they come to work. This is the only thing we're worried about. All right, IDPH, Illinois Department of Public Health. The website is where I pulled those Champaign County numbers from at the beginning. They also tracked close contacts quarantine through the pandemic. And so it is my understanding these numbers are for the entire pandemic. So from April 1st is when I think they started tracking numbers, April 1st, 2020. I might not be right on this with close contacts. It might be for a different time frame, but I believe it was for the entire pandemic. So close contacts quarantine were 36,665. So you had somebody test positive and you were considered a close contact. You were living with them. You were in contact with them very closely for greater than 15 minutes. This is how many close contacts were quarantined. Of those close contacts quarantined, of that 36,665, 4,273 turned positive. So that's 11.6%. So you had around 12% chance of actually coming positive if you were in close contact with someone who was positive. So I look at that from the reverse. You have around a 90% chance, 88 to 90% chance of not testing positive, of not getting sick when you are directly exposed. So let's look at this again. We got 0.16% of the staff at the hospital. Some of those are not even in direct patient care or in contact with anyone. This might be somebody sitting at a computer in IT. okay? 0.16% of staff last week was positive for this virus, okay? And of that 0.16% of staff, say 0.16% of staff was in contact with someone, you have 11% chance of turning positive after being in contact with this person. 90% chance you wouldn't. If you wanted to really do some math here and run some numbers, it could get pretty interesting, right? Pretty interesting to see the minute chance of actually getting sick. What are we doing? What are we doing? Like, this is just nuts. We're basing decisions on people's livelihood, on people's medical care, off of this, these wild numbers. It's just blowing my mind. So it's just frustrating to me that I'm losing my job. You know, I'm pretty much over the losing my job portion at this point. It's just the principle behind it. But this is about everyone. This isn't just about me. There is so much that factors into this. And I just, what are we doing? All right, let's talk about ICU numbers. This email, these hikes emails that are sent out, and I will put in the show notes, if you don't understand what hikes is, it's just like a metric for going down events like this, I guess. Like, what are we doing? What do the numbers look like? How are we mitigating? That kind of thing. So these emails are put out weekly, basically just to show how we're doing and what our goals are and what our mitigation goals continue to be. So I'm just going to read this portion regarding ICU. While the hospital continues to see a high number of hospitalizations due to COVID-19, hospitalizations are decreasing, but the ICU rate remains steady. The below graph provides the amount of hospitalized patients in both general medical units and intensive care units, and the vaccination status of individuals. The data continues to confirm the COVID-19 vaccine helps prevent hospitalization and severity of disease. Okay, so I have a few questions there because, yes, ICU numbers are remaining higher, but when you go to the ICU numbers, it says ICU patients with COVID-19. So that could be somebody who is tested positive but may not be there with a primary concern of COVID. That's a possibility. So this is something that would need to be addressed if we're actually really looking at how we're doing with this. Another question I have is, what is the hospital length of stay time? Are these patients weekly? Because if you see hospitalizations going down, a length of stay for a regular medical unit tends to be a lot less than an ICU. I mean, some of these patients that we're putting on ECMO are staying on for a month or better. So these patients week to week might be the same patients. It would be very interesting and much more telling if they would give more information as to how many of these patients in the ICU were new admissions this week. How many of them have been carried over from week to week to week and are still staying, you know, maybe not getting better and still staying in the ICU. All right. I just want to clarify too, I am not diminishing the fact that there are people getting sick. There absolutely are. But I've said this so many times. We have opened a window to a world that most people never saw before. Most people never saw the inside of the ICU before. I received a message from a gal the other day. She was saying I can't remember if it was a friend or a sister-in-law, is an ICU nurse. And they had attended an event, like an outdoor concert or something, and wore their masks and all this kind of stuff. And her sister-in-law still text her, you don't see what I see. You guys aren't vaccinated. I work in an ICU and I just love you guys so much. And I'm so anxious for you. You know, I took care of a young guy the other day and it just reminds me of, you know, my brother, or I think it was her brother. And I said, yeah, that's very real. That is very real. And I feel that because as an ICU nurse for 15 plus years, I have experienced the anxiety before. I remember a very particular situation where a patient had a tick-borne illness and was in the ICU. And it was one of the most gruesome things I've seen, one of the most gruesome deaths. And we spend a lot of time outdoors, me and my family. We spend a lot of time in the woods. And I remember that next summer having anxiety, you know, going to the woods like, oh my gosh, this could happen. This could happen. This is a very real thing. But in the perspective of things, you know, that happen, you know, across the board, the likelihood of that happening to me is low. And I guess you have to take into consideration, there is a level of risk that comes with living. And what kind of world are we willing to create in the name of safety that possibly and likely denies us actually living life? You know, what do you consider living? And so I told this girl, I said, yeah, that's very real. You know, nurses have always carried, especially ICU and ER nurses, you know, who really deal with the majority of death. I don't want to diminish the fact that, you know, I'm not saying medical nurses don't deal with that, but a very high percentage of people do die in an ICU. And we do see some very awful things. And we do carry a bit of anxiety that comes with that, I think, especially certain periods of your nursing career. I would say for me, it's different for everybody, but for me, it was greater at the beginning, maybe greater after a few years in, I should say, and then kind of wore off with time, not because of my time as a nurse, but because of my deepening faith. And I think that it is very important to have a rooted faith if you want to make it through as an ICU nurse. And I know I'm diverting from the topic I really originally kind of started talking about, but I think it's important to include here. You know, we do carry a level of anxiety, or a lot of us do. A lot of us do carry a level of anxiety and a level of reality. I guess I should say a level of reality that life is very fragile. But that has always been carried strictly with us. The pandemic situation has given every nurse permission to push her anxiety or his anxiety off onto everyone around them. And tell everyone everything you see in the ICU. It was kind of like Vegas before I've said this too, you know, that saying what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas. It's like the ICU, what happens in the ICU stays in the ICU. Nobody else knows, you know. I can tell my husband some of the things I saw during the day that are bothering me, but unless you actually see it, you don't actually know. But when you've constantly exposed the public to something that the public never saw and they were never prepared to see, they were never prepared to cope with, that's creating more anxiety, and it's creating the policies that you're seeing surrounding this. So anyway, off that tangent. So, okay, one more Champaign County number, then I'm going to move on to some Canada number Cecily gave me. Okay, so from April 1st, 2020 to now, so covering 19 months, there's been 27,451 cases. Of those 27,451 cases, there's been 207 deaths. Of those 207, 174 have been 60 plus. And the largest majority of those, I think, were 80 to 90 year olds. So I'm putting in the show notes these links so you can go look. The numbers that I talked about, some of them will be different because they're running tally day to day. But very interesting to consider these numbers when you think about what are we doing. All right, let's move on to Canada, BC. Okay, so Cecily said in BC, the population is around 5 million. And these are just numbers we were spitting back and forth the other night as I was just like kind of in shock after my first phone call with HR and just like, what in the heck is happening? Okay, so population 5 million. Active cases, 5,000 to 6,000, somewhere between there. So doing the math, that's 0.086% of the population is involved as an active case. 90% of the eligible population for a vaccine, 90% of the eligible population has been vaccinated. 85% have had at least one dose. So 85% at least one dose, 90% have been vaccinated. I'm not really sure how that figures out, but that's what Cecily told me there. Either way, very high vaccination rate, very, very high. All right. Then she was looking up numbers for the day. We were discussing this on October 28th, 2021, so just a few days ago. As she was looking up numbers for the day of October 28th, she came across the numbers for 1 year ago that day. So on October 28th, 2020, a year ago, there were 287 new cases announced that day. 287, 1 year ago. On October 28, 2021, this year, there were over 600 new cases that day. So we over doubled the caseload from year to year with a 90% vaccination rate this year. And last year, vaccinations were just starting. What are we doing? Okay, a few weeks ago, we covered Rochelle Walensky's we played it on the podcast, her stating that the vaccine can no longer prevent transmission. It does not prevent transmission. We covered the FDA stating that we hope it prevents transmission, but we're not sure. So there's that. I covered the other day on Instagram, and I'm going to read through some of this here, statements Fauci made. So this was from March 22nd, 2021. So he says, this is from CNN Health. The vaccine efficacy rates vary only with respects to mild forms of COVID illness. When it comes to measures that really matter, hospitalizations and death, they are all functionally the same, he continued. So, all right, that first statement, vaccine efficacy rates only vary with respect to mild forms of COVID illness, is an admission of infection ability. It's an admission of ability to be infected. An ability to be infected is an ability to transmit. So this is showing that the vaccine, what he's saying here is the vaccine should lessen severe illness, but it does not prevent transmission. In this article, he also stated, I'm just going to go through this really quick, that he's talking about the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, and I will include this also in the show notes, and saying that it's virtually 100% protective against hospitalizations and death. This is March 22nd, 2021. And in USA Today, in March also, this is March 6, 2021. Our advice is simple. Take whatever vaccine is offered to you right now. Right now, all of the vaccines are the best. This is what we're doing for ourselves. The varying effectiveness rates miss the most important point. The vaccines were all 100% effective in the vaccine trials in stopping hospitalizations and death. So they're telling you that it's 100% chance that you will not die. You have 0% chance of dying if you get the COVID vaccine. The Miami Herald, March 3rd, 2021, same thing. Vaccines were all 100% effective in the vaccine trials and stopping hospitalizations and death. Which back then, when they put these out, I was just like, what are they even talking about? There's nothing that's 100%. Nothing. You cannot say that. Okay, so I called that marketing of the vaccine. And now we have rebranding. So October 19th, 2021, this is just after Colin Powell died. There's an article that comes out from CNN Health also. The headline's reading, why vaccinated people dying from COVID-19 doesn't mean the vaccines are ineffective. Okay, it says, however, COVID vaccine does not protect you 100%. No vaccine does. Just like virtually no medical treatment is 100% effective. That does not mean the vaccine does not work or that you shouldn't take it. Okay, so why did I just read through those? How does that relate? It's admission of transmission. It's admission of inability to prevent the disease. It's telling you it helps prevent severe illness and death, or it should, but it's not 100% even at that. It's an admission that it should be a choice. And that's why I read through that. So the reason I'm going through all this, sorry, I've got papers flipping here just because I've got articles everywhere and I had numbers everywhere and I just wanted to make sure I got that all right. So why am I going through all this? Because it matters. It matters. What is happening to me and what is happening to so many others, the context surrounding this, the context surrounding what is happening matters and it needs to be talked about. The hospital continues to frame the rationale for the mandates, testing, and masking, and the marketing campaign surrounding it, the ongoing marketing campaign surrounding it, they continue to frame it around a transmission reduction. They continue to frame it around transmission prevention. When it is clear and it is very openly stated that it does nothing of the sort. It does not prevent transmission. It does not even reduce transmission. There are articles, I should have pulled them and I'll put them in show notes, that have stated that those who have the virus and are vaccinated have the same viral load on the nasopharyngeal swabs as those who are unvaccinated. So we have to look at this information, we have to talk about it, and we have to start asking the question, what are we doing here? If we're going to allow hiring and firing, if we're going to allow employers to perform like medical interventions, test procedures, employ medical devices upon us, especially without the evidence to back it up, we've willingly entered a very, very dangerous territory. We've willingly entered it if we're allowing this. We have to stand up to it. We have to start asking questions. And that is why I'm doing what I'm doing, because this is a very slippery slope we're getting into by allowing our employer to issue medical tests, issue medical devices to us without any rationale. And I think that it is even scarier. Some people think, oh, when you work in a hospital, like, this is just part of the game. And they're more worried about it happening at a bank or a school or a factory of some sort. No, I think that it is even more scary on the medical front, given the fact that the government is issuing these mandates and executive orders. And the medical community should be the ones questioning this, because they should be the ones that use the evidence-based practice. They say they use evidence-based practice. They should be the ones looking at this data and interpreting it and using it and saying, hey, what I'm seeing isn't matching up with what we're doing. And they're not. And so I would say, for those of you who are going along with this because you work in medicine, you expect that your employer will expect you to be injected with things and wear medical devices and things, you should be more concerned than the average citizen who works at a bank or a factory or, you know, any other type of job. And those are just examples, but you should be more concerned in a medical environment where the job is interpreting data and looking at infection rates and all of this. You should be more concerned than the average citizen who works at a facility that isn't in line with normally doing that, right? So that's why I'm so concerned right now. That's why I'm doing what I'm doing. So let's talk a little bit about what happened to me and the hospital situation. Okay, so the Friday before I went to work. So I work every, or worked, I should say. This is all past tense now, worked. I worked every Wednesday. I was typically UNL or charge nurse on my unit every single Wednesday. Occasionally, I wasn't when I was the ECMO nurse. So that was my role. That was my work day. I went to work on August 11th, knowing that the prior Friday, my CEO of my hospital had issued an email, and I'm going to read a little bit of that here just so you know what I'm referring to. It's very long. I won't read it. I'm just going to read the highlighting parts. So Monday, August 9th, unvaccinated team members will be required to wear an N95 mask as long as they are working in a hospital or insurance building. I've said my hospital publicly now on social media, accidentally actually yesterday, and I just went with it. I'm not going to include it all here. Okay. So distribution of N95 masks will begin next week and will reach clinical work areas first before being distributed to non-patient care facilities. So I work in a patient care area, supposed to start on Monday. I get texts from my friends that Monday and Tuesday both saying it's not even happening. Because I was like, I'll probably get fired Wednesday because I am not wearing an N95. If you don't understand the difference between this, a surgical mask and an N95 are much different. I will include in the show notes also a link to CDC documentation. CDC documentation stating that it is unsafe for extended wear. You are not supposed to be wearing these masks all day. Therefore, short-term use, typically in airborne precaution rooms, they are fitted. These are masks that have been fitted to you. Some people cannot wear an N95. They wear a capper instead, which is a piece that goes on your head with a shield over it, with space underneath of it where the air can get out. And the air blows down from this helmet down past your mouth and nose and blows your air out into the common space. N95s and cappers are used interchangeably. It's just a matter of what you are fitted for. These are used in aerosolizing procedures and patients who are on isolation. So typically short-term use when you're in an isolation room and when it's required, not all day. Another thing that I want to highlight from this email, it says this feedback, is they're talking about a form that we need to fill out if we haven't had the vaccine. It says this feedback will be used to inform our decisions on possible vaccine exemptions and or additional mitigation or corrective measures for unvaccinated team members. So the CEO is stating that these measures are corrective for us. They are measures taken because we didn't do what we were supposed to do. They also sent along with this email an FAQ. It says, what are some of the consequences being considered for those team members that do not get the vaccine? And then it lists, effective immediately, will begin issuing an N95 mask to all unvaccinated team members, and they will be required to wear one or to wear in a hospital or insurance building. As we seek to understand the unvaccinated team member perspectives, we are considering additional mitigation measures such as, but not limited to, additional PPE, regular testing, and higher health insurance premium. So they list that this is a consequence. Consequence equals punishment. Synonyms. All right. So that happened. I was told it's not being enforced. I come to work on Wednesday. I walk in and I find that I'm the ECMO nurse that day. I'm the core ECMO member taking care of a patient on VA ECMO, not the primary nurse. Walk in, talk to my friend who's the primary nurse that day. I'm like, this is going to be a great day. We get to work together all day. This is awesome. I'm caring for the pump and making sure everything's running great, and you're taking care of the patient, and we're just going to work as a team. This is going to be awesome. I was so happy for my shift. I remember I walked in and I was stripping a chest tube, talking to her, getting the patient ready to go. The patient had to go to cath lab. So we were packing up. We were talking to perfusionists. They had come in because we kind of do the perfusion role as the ECMO nurse. And then if we go on a road trip, we do have the perfusionist come in. So we were talking to them. And I said, hey, I'm not going to stay in cath lab with you. I'll just pack you up and help you get down there. But I'm pregnant, so I don't really want to stay in cath lab and accept the radiation down there. And so that was the first time I told her. It was a really great day. We were super excited. We're good friends. And it was just like a really great morning. A few minutes later, I go out and I'm starting to chart a bit on my pump numbers, and the manager walks by me, and she's with the CNO, and they immediately stop at the desk I'm sitting at, and the manager pipes in and she says, hi Rita, you can just wanted to let you know that you can tell the secretary your what N95 you typically wear, what one you're fitted for, and you can get that to put on now. And I said, I am not going to be participating in retaliation against me for a personal decision. I am not wearing an N95. She's like, what do you mean? I'm like, this hospital is a no retaliation facility, and this is a personal decision, and I'm not participating in this. I said, it's a self-stated corrective measure or consequence of not getting the vaccine, and I'm not participating. It is unsafe. It is unsafe for all day wear, and I am not doing it. And it ended up being a very long conversation, which I won't bore you with, but I will tell you that another nurse came up from cath lab that used to work in the ICU with us. This nurse has a large beard, and was wearing an N95 for which he is not fitted for. He said that he is fitted for a capper, which is this large shield and helmet situation. I inquired into that, you know, how is this helping if you're wearing an N95 that you're not fitted for? And then you're going to tell him he can wear a capper, but it's blowing his air into the common area. That just doesn't make sense. This is illogical. This is obviously a punishment. It's not helping anyone. It's not keeping anyone safe. And they said, well, it's for your safety. And I said, but you said all last year, you know, we've always worn masks for our own safety, but all last year you changed it to I protect you, you protect me. That's why we were wearing these surgical masks, you said. And she said, well, yes, but it's okay if they're wearing the capper and it's blowing the air out, because the other person, you know, who's vaccinated would have a surgical mask on as well, and they would be protecting themselves. I said, again, you said surgical masks aren't to, you know, the N95 is for our protection, but surgical masks are for other people's protection. So now, again, you've changed the language. Like, none of this is making sense. And the conversation continued on, and she said, so you just won't wear one? You're putting me in a really bad position. And I said, well, I feel that you're putting me in a really bad position. So she said, well, I'll go call HR. I can't make exceptions for you. Meanwhile, there's another nurse standing, sitting there the whole time, also unvaccinated, doesn't have an N95 on. Eventually, this nurse got up and got one and put it on, but proceeded to talk to the other person there who is the director of our unit. So manager, then above them is director, above them CNO. Those are the people present. She's talking to the director with the mask around her chin. The N95 is around her chin. No one says a word. And this is not a dig at that nurse. I'm fine with it. I don't care. It's a dig at the management who is singling me out. I will tell you, the CNO that talked to me that day, the last time I saw her on the unit was for a meeting about 3 years ago during the day. I haven't seen her on the unit. So I felt very much, and everyone on the unit felt very much, that I have talked to anyways, that I was being singled out that day. So anyway, went back in the room, packed up my patient, got the patient on the elevator with the staff going down with him, walked back into the unit, at which point I was met by the director, manager, CNO, and told that I would be asked to leave for the rest of the day. This is about 9:30 in the morning. And they would be in contact with me to see what the next steps were. So I packed up, left for that day. As I'm walking out, I pass another unvaccinated nurse who's still wearing a surgical mask, and an RT still wearing a surgical mask. Nothing was said to them. No one rounded on them at all. Leave for the day and get called by HR the next day. They offer me, because at the time I was pregnant, they offered me a reasonable medical exemption to the N95. Because of being pregnant. And I said, no, I'm not taking it, because what happens when I'm not pregnant? The point of me not wearing this mask isn't because of a pregnancy. I still want oxygen. I still deserve to be able to breathe adequately when I'm at work, when I'm not pregnant, and all of my coworkers do too. I will say also, the day I was asked to leave, I told the CNO that the only reason I'm being asked to leave today that you can speak to is because I'm being honest with you that I won't participate in this, because I guarantee this will not be enforced throughout the hospital after I leave. And it hasn't been. It hasn't been. I have picture documentation of other people not in masks, standing next to my manager, mind you, after my manager told me it was being enforced. Like, it's just wild to me. This has not been enforced at all. So I didn't take the reasonable medical exemption that was offered to me. Emails went back and forth, multiple emails with me asking questions about this, asking questions about the safety, the implementation, the fact that they told me it was an OSHA mandate, the N95, when I know it's not an OSHA mandate because not all hospitals are following this. I also read the OSHA ETS, where it clearly stated that it was not a mandate. Like, it just clearly stated the only time that they're requiring N95s are for aerosolizing procedures and where it is expected in a proper isolation room. But my hospital said it was a mandate. Then they walked it back to it was a guideline from OSHA. verbally on the phone the other day, they walked it back to me that it was just a policy. It was just a policy of the hospital. It was not anything to do with OSHA. So I didn't take that reasonable medical exemption. In the meantime, I've had a lot of personal things happen in my life. My email password actually expired from the hospital, and then I had some personal events, which we likely will talk about eventually on this podcast. Not ready for that today. But I just focused on other things. I had other things to focus on. And I was just getting to a point where I could start focusing on this again. And my manager messaged me last Friday and asked if I had any plans to return to the workplace under the conditions. Now the governor has put out a weekly testing requirement. So we have to be tested if we're unvaccinated weekly and document that test. And that test can be done after we have worked for the week, but we have to have a weekly test documented. So she asked if I had any intentions of returning with the N95 all day wear requirement or weekly testing requirement, to which I said no. I do not have any intentions, at least until all of my questions have been answered, and my questions have not been addressed. I have email documentation of my questions and them not being addressed. I said, no, I'm not planning to return, but I will return if those questions are answered adequately and when this all makes sense. And I also included the weekly COVID numbers and ask like, what's the plan? Like these vaccinated team members, quote, team members, I have to use that in quotes because obviously it's not really a team environment there. These unvaccinated team members are less for the last 3 weeks out with COVID than the vaccinated team members. There are more. So long story short, I received an email on Monday from the VP of HR, who is the same person that called me back in August. I did not receive that email, though, personally because of my password situation and not having that resolved yet. So Wednesday, I receive a call from him, and he stated that he sent the email. I said, I did not see it. I need to get my password fixed. We had a conversation surrounding my intentions for employment, and he offered he didn't tell me exactly what the position would be, but he's like, would you be open to looking for a different position, like at home where you wouldn't have to come to the facility? And I said, no, because it's the same thing. By me, this is my reason, guys, by me participating in this testing, I am admitting that somehow I am more of a risk than my vaccinated counterparts, which the numbers show is not true. By me wearing an N95 as a punishment at work, I am agreeing that somehow I'm more of a risk to my patients and to my coworkers than my vaccinated counterparts, which the numbers show are that it is not true. And by me accepting a work from home position, which would be an auditing position or some kind of position where I'm looking through paperwork, which is not something I'm good at. Like, I'm not good at that. That's not a God-given skill I have. I am a really good ICU nurse. I am not a paper pusher. It's just not something I'm good at. They would probably be very unhappy with the work I provided. By doing that, I would also be admitting that I am somehow more of a risk. I am too risky to be at work with my patients untested. Okay, fine, test me, but also test everyone else, because it is a lie to say that I am more of a risk to my patients or to my coworkers than these other vaccinated team members, which are coming up at a higher rate for the last 3 weeks than the unvaccinated team members. And he, you know, this HR guy, when I say that, he says, well, you know, we have an 85% vaccination rate, so there are many more vaccinated team members. You know, I get that. I understand that. And the argument would hold water if you were testing all of the vaccinated team members, but you aren't. You're only testing the ones that are requesting a test because they're sick. If you were testing every single one of them, I guarantee the numbers would indicate the rate of infection is probably close to the same. And so you cannot use that argument when you're not employing the same testing frequency, right? And so I just can't live this lie. I can't live this lie because it perpetuates into society and creates a society that bases decisions and bases treatments off of lies. And I cannot do that. I cannot do that to my children. And that's why I'm doing this. So he asked me if I had any intentions of returning the workplace under these conditions. I said, no. I said, I need these questions answered. I have an email that I have sent multiple times, multiple requests for information that is not being provided to me. And I expect these questions to be answered. I've also requested an in-person appointment with the CNO, which has not happened yet. He kind of hem-hawed around, and he told me also that we philosophically disagree and just use a bunch of managerial mumbo jumbo that just, you know how that sounds when they talk, you know, it's a bunch of words that mean nothing, but they're just saying a lot of words to try to sound important. And it's just very annoying to me when people talk that way. Very annoying. I don't know. I think I said, on Instagram the other day that I have we disagree philosophically. And I said, yes, I have a philosophical aversion to BS. Like, that's what I mean. Like, I just can't stand that managerial, like, lingo that absolutely means nothing, talking in circles and trying to talk above you. It's just gross. But anyway, that's what most of the conversation consisted of. And I ended up asking him, I said, so are you going to fire me? And he said, well, you leave us with very little option. I mean, that's the next step, essentially. And I said, that's fine. You can fire me, but I am not quitting. You are quitting me. And he said, I really would like you to consider a little further. I said, that's fine. You know what? I've got some people I can talk to. Call me back Friday. This was Wednesday. I said, call me back Friday. So he calls me back Friday. We have the conversation again. I explained to him again my rationale, ask him the same pointed questions again, because I had sent them in an email the day before on Thursday. I sent another email asking all the questions, lining out that I've been singled out, lining out the fact that the N95 has not been enforced and I have documentation proof of it, and asking questions about the testing, asking questions of how you can tell me an executive order has been issued and that's why you're following these guidelines, but as a medical facility, you can provide me with no evidence-based data points stating that the information you have shows that we're taking the right action, right? And he continued to say, well, it's an executive order. We're just following it executive orders. And the conversation ended with him saying, well, I'm going to process a resignation now. And I said, I am absolutely not resigning. I've been very clear that I am not resigning. I'm not quitting. I have never and never in any way, shape, or form asked for a resignation. This is not a resignation. And he proceeded to say, you can frame this however you want. I am processing it as such, and I am processing a resignation now. And he hung up. I immediately went to get onto my email, could not get onto my work email. I posted in my work CVICU Facebook group, just in all caps, I did not resign. And then I posted again what happened, just a very brief summary of what I just told you in that phone call. One of the tattletale nurses that I work with saw it immediately, and so they told the manager, and I was pulled from that group. And I'm sure all of the nurses listening, any of the nurses I work with, will know exactly which nurse I'm talking about. We've all got those people that we work with. Anyway, that was kind of a dig. I probably shouldn't have done that, but it's true. We've just got those people that, you know, they're friends to your face and you always know they're going to talk behind your back. You don't even have to question it. You know they're talking behind your back, but everybody has those people and we just need to strive not to be like that. So I went to get on my email. I posted to the Facebook group, and the next thing I did was got on my personal email. I emailed and documented to the human resources broad general email to the human resources VP, the CNO, and my manager that I, in fact, did not resign. Very clearly stated I did not resign, and then requested all 15 years of my annual reviews be provided to me in a timely fashion, as I was an outstanding employee, and that is documented proof on those annual reviews. Never been in disciplinary action before, and my peer reviews were excellent as well. So that's what happened to me. That's what I'm in the process of. I was prepared to be fired. I wasn't prepared to be in a forced resignation resignation situation where I have never signed any paperwork. This is an illegal resignation, essentially. All right. One more thing that I didn't get to in terms of numbers and like why this matters. You know, why does this matter? Our hospital is hiring travelers out the wazoo. I talked to somebody who I know that has a family member in the ICU right now, and they said they've received good care from the travelers, which is just a typical, I shouldn't say typical or just a typical, but it's a typical ICU admission. These travelers are taken care of. They said they've received very good care. And I'm not indicating that travelers are bad nurses by any means. I've worked with some really, really good travelers. But it's a problem when you employ mostly travelers or are getting to a point where you have majority of shifts covered by travelers, because just for example, something that happens in the ICU, not super often, but it happens after open heart surgery, like we would need to crack a chest. There's a specific procedure. We go to training on that really regularly. And so if you have to open a chest, you need to know where that cart is. You need to know what's in it. You need to know the team members you're working with and the roles that they have and what they're capable of. This is one very specific example. But once you get to a point where you don't have that camaraderie with your team members that you've worked with for a very long time, if you don't know where things are at or who to call, who's capable of what the typical procedures are, that gets to be a very dangerous situation. But anyways, this person I know said, yes, most of the care that we've received is from travel nurses. And I would never have asked, but it opened a conversation because of following you and hearing kind of what you've been talking about. So one thing I want to read, another email that was put out a few weeks ago covered September diversion. So patients that request, like admissions that were requested to come to our hospital from likely outlying facilities, other care facilities and things, but we didn't admit them. We sent them to another healthcare facility, not our own. They were requesting a bed there and we did not give it to them. So in September, there were 298 total diversions. The month before, there were 525. It says 271 capacity diversions. I'm not sure the difference between the 298 and 271, but they broke this down for why those diversions occurred. It says there were 192 ICU diversions, and it was due to staffing. And then it breaks down the different units that they went to. So of all the diversions that happened, of that 271, only five of those diversions were a bed situation where we didn't have a bed physically to put the patient in. All the rest of them were due to staffing. So we have a major staffing issue, and we're losing nurses to pay issues. One, because you're paying these travelers tons of money. These travelers are getting up to $6,500 a week to work in the ICU, and our hospital is not paying those travelers. They've gotten a state grant, so the taxpayers are paying for those travelers, and the staff nurses who work there are still taking care of the heavier patients who have the more higher care devices like ECMO, balloon pumps, open heart surgeries, those kind of things, but they're being paid much less to do so. So they're leaving and traveling themselves or finding different jobs because they're sick and tired of not getting paid the same as these other nurses working with them. That's one problem. You have the vaccine mandate and people leaving because of that. And we're making decisions on this vaccine mandate and the morale is going down. And we're making these decisions based on the numbers I just gave you. And that's why I'm asking, what are we doing? Like, this just doesn't make sense. This doesn't make sense. So what are we doing? What's happening? I think why this is happening is because we're fighting for our rights. Like, it's very necessary. It's a very necessary thing to fight for these very basic rights, because once they're gone, we're not going to get them back. But as we fight for these rights, it gets people divided into two different camps, an opt-in camp and an opt-out camp. And we're two sides fighting against each other, fighting for our rights, fighting for our liberties. And as we do that, we have very little energy and very little headspace to put towards anything else. And the anything else is, that's what's going on behind the scenes that we need to be paying attention to. And we will get into this on the podcast more later down the road. I or Cecily or both of us together will do some episodes on it. But some of this stuff we have already covered. And I'm just going to run down a couple things. ESG scores, biodigital, the destruction of our economy, the elites and the innocents, those things we have talked about, those are the things that are going on behind the scenes that we are being distracted of. This is a very necessary distraction, a necessary fight, but it's a distraction nonetheless. So let's talk about this. Let's have these conversations with people because we need to talk about what are we doing? What are we doing? Where are we leading ourselves? And it's just, oh man, who are these people making our decisions to? Who are these people making our decisions? Are these people in the NIH? Are these people like Dr. Fauci who just was found to have conducted these studies on beagles that were super unethical? I mean, just look it up. I'll also put a link to this in the show notes. These unethical people going to make ethical decisions for us? What are we doing? Why are we doing it? And who are we allowing to do these things? All right, guys, thanks for listening. I know this is a bit of a long episode and a bit of a story, but just be asking yourselves these questions and be having conversations. All right, if you want to find me outside the podcast, you can find me, Rita, at RitaRogersCo.com or RitaRogersCo on Instagram. And you can find Cecily at Cecily.Dickey on Instagram or thegracetogrow.com. Thanks for listening.